everybody. You are listening to the 13 Club podcast. My name is Miranda.
And I am Kim.
And you are joining us today for a post-mortem episode. These are one of our, like, mini-sodes, you could call them. So these are a little bit shorter and sweeter. Well, maybe not sweeter, but they're a little bit shorter, theoretically, than our normal episodes.
Bite-sized.
Exactly. That's B-Y-T-E, because we're cyber spooky.
Who should go first? I think that this time I should go first because I think you should go first during the episode.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay. So mine is just like a quick little article about something that like my husband and I joke about all the time. And it's did you ever hear about Korean fan death? Like, fan, like, F-A-N.
Maybe.
So, it was, like, this belief that if you slept in a room that was closed with a fan on, that you would die because all of the air would get sucked out of the room.
No, but I think I've heard about something similar in Japan.
I would believe it. It's just, like, this is a little article that I thought was kind of funny because it's written by somebody who grew up believing that.
Okay.
So, it's on The Atlantic, and I hope The Atlantic doesn't give us a cease and desist for this, but it's by Katie Haney.
Okay.
And the title is... Is my electric fan going to kill me in my sleep? Concerns about fan death in Korea are unfounded, but persist because of the power of belief. When I was a kid, someone told me that running a fan too close to my face was dangerous to my health, and I've kind of believed it ever since. For the 20-some years since, I've assumed that that person was one of my parents, but when I mentioned this to them recently, neither of them had any idea what I was talking about. That doesn't sound like something I'd believe, my dad said, and he's right, it doesn't. But I know someone in my home once told me to move my fan further away from my bed so I wouldn't get sick overnight, and if it wasn't my parents, then who was it? My best guess at this time was a paranoid babysitter. No matter that I never encountered any substantiating evidence, the idea of, fans' concentrated breeze making me sick held enough intuitive sway in my childhood psyche that it stuck there. Even though I know now that it isn't exactly true, I wonder if there's something to this idea. It had to come from somewhere, right? In fact, many cultures across the globe have their own stories of wind-based illnesses, says Frank Beerus, author of The Geography of Madness. In this book, Beerus writes that some ancient Chinese medical texts warned readers of wind insanity and even wind stupidity. Variations on these beliefs persist today, too. In Italy, people wear scarves around their necks to protect against colpo d'aria, which is a hint of air. And in the... it's a hit of air.
A hit of air, okay.
And in the Czech Republic, some... people fear that the wind from air conditioners and refrigerators, believing that they cause rheumatism, among other health issues. Most, if not all, Americans have been told not to go outside with wet hair because they will catch a chill, a belief in cause and effect model with little scientific backing. My mom still thinks that.
My mom definitely said that to me all the time when I was a kid.
Sorry for the call out, Mom. Perhaps the most extreme form of this illness, these supposed illnesses, can be found in Korea, where they call it something else, fan death, or the belief that running a fan in an enclosed room will actually kill you. Fears about electric fans in Korea seem to date back as early as 1927, when a story called Strange Harm from Electric Fans was printed in Jungo Ilbo, Domestic and International Daily. Warning readers that new technology came with a risk of nausea, facial paralysis, and even asphyxiation. The theory there is being that the fan's circulation of stale air causes its user to choke on their own carbon dioxide. 50 or so years later, Beerus tells me that a Korean man was reportedly found dead in his room, the windows and doors shut, and two electric fans were running. Beerus attributes the prominence of the modern fan death myth to this case. ever since stories of supposed fan deaths have appeared regularly in South Korea, particularly in the summer months. That's how these things go, said Buras. You can't necessarily prove that the wind killed the person. And in a way, it doesn't matter, because everyone believes it's the fan. Some suggest that the fan death myth was even propagated by the South Korean government to curb the use of electricity during the 1970s energy crisis. The specific root or roots of the widespread belief are difficult to pinpoint, says Buras. But what matters most, in his view, is the way that the belief in fan death and other impossible conditions, like, which he calls it cultural syndromes, self-perpetuates. The only way something like this can spread is if people believe in the cause at the root of it. If you believe that wind can have this harmful effect, or something about an electric fan can, then it can spread, says Buras. If no one believes it, then it won't spread. Fan death may not make as much sense to those of us living outside Korea, but the chemtrail conspiracy probably doesn't make much sense to people living outside the United States, and more specifically Hollywood, either. The threats and specters may vary from culture to culture and country to country, but what unites them is the strength of people's belief in them, even in the near total absence of evidence. In his book, Buras writes, "Hearing about a cultural syndrome was one of the primary risk factors. In that sense, certain cultural syndromes can be made real by our belief in them, a phenomenon called the nocebo effect, where negative expectations can start a chain of harmful events which ultimately fulfill those expectations. While it remains extremely unlikely that believing it a fan can kill you will directly cause the fan to kill you, and the potency of the nocebo effect depends on a number of contextual factors, there is evidence to suggest that belief in one's potential to experience a given medical crisis makes a person more susceptible to it. If you read the side effects on a medicine, you're more likely to experience those side effects, says Buras. In a randomized clinical trial, researchers will warn people about the side effects of a drug or a treatment, and people in the placebo group will sometimes have to drop out because their side effects are so severe. As a mild hypochondriac, this seems terribly unfair to me. One would think that the constant worrying was punishment enough. But as long as the credulity is there, so will be the possibility of fan death. Not because our electric fans are actually asphyxiating us, but because enough people believe that they could. As for me, I still keep my own fan at least 3 feet away from the bed. I don't necessarily think sending it closer would make me sick, but I don't particularly want to find out for sure either."
Yeah, that was a good one. That was cute.
Yeah, Justin, my husband, and I always joke about that whenever, like, we turn the fan on at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, all right, it was nice knowing you. It was a good marriage. Goodbye.
I think people would be horrified by our setup. We had live in a basement apartment with central AC, but our upstairs neighbors have control over the heat and AC.
Oh God, yeah.
And they, I think, must be actual lizard people, because it is always hot in the summer, and they literally never turn the AC on. Like, I'm talking 90 plus degree days, not counting the humidity, and there's no AC going. So we have like one of those big ones, like that stands in the floor with like a hose, yeah, that goes out the window.
A portable.
But it's so big, and our apartment's so small, there's no place for it. So it, like, literally sits directly next to our bed, and we have it on, like, 24/7.
Yeah, because you have to.
There's no other option, yeah.
We have a little, like, they're called mini splits, or, like, a ductless air thing. Mm-hmm. And we have one right next to our bed, and then we still sleep with two fans on.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you're all
ready to die.
You're always in hot, like, temperatures, though, so at least you have that.
Yeah,
like, you have a reason.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, for my topic today, I wanted to revisit the, like, little personal story that I shared last episode, and I was talking about the, like, pumpkinhead people.
Yeah.
So I looked that up. I found it on the Weird USA website, so I can read for you guys exactly the thing that I read when I was a kid. And I'm going to...
Wow, that's awesome.
I'm going to have to start off by correcting myself, because they were not pumpkinheads. They were melon heads.
Okay, because I've heard of that.
Okay. So I was stupid and obviously misremembering from when I was a kid. But
now we need some pumpkin head fan art.
Yes. That I...
That's your OC.
Please, oh my god. Okay. Okay, so... When the cryptozoologist in you gets tired of hearing the same old stories about Bigfoot, skunk apes, and the Loch Ness Monster, and you're looking for something new to sink your teeth into, head on over to Lake County, Ohio, and check out the Melon Heads. Weird, human-like creatures with enormous heads that roam the countryside in and around Kirtland and Chardon, Ohio. Regarding the origins of the Melon Heads, the popular belief is that they were a result of secret government testing that involved strange experiments on human subjects. Whatever they were testing, the result was that the subjects' heads all swelled to enormous sizes. Like any good government conspiracy, it was decided that the best thing to do would be to cover the whole thing up. A secret location in the middle of the woods was quickly established, and the Melon Heads were all shipped there in the middle of the night. Since they were well taken care of, the Melon Heads were, for the most part, a passive bunch. However, every once in a while, one of them would grow restless for contact with the outside world. Usually waiting until cover of darkness, a melon head or two would every so often slip outside their little commune and creep through the woods towards civilization. More often than not, just a glimpse of the outside world would be all a melon head would need to send them scampering back to the safety of their little town, which is said to be somewhere in the woods near Wisner Road. There are a few offshoots of the melon head's legend in which a doctor is featured predominantly. In those versions, the doctor's name is Crow, spelled either C-R-O-W-E or C-R-O-W. In the first version, Dr. Crow has somehow managed to acquire, either by kidnapping or through a secret deal with the mental hospital he works at, several individuals that he subjects to bizarre experiments, most of which focus on the brain and head. Due to the severe trauma, the individuals' heads are deformed and misshapen. But since some of Dr. Crow's experiments also included lobotomies, the melon heads are rather docile, if not a bit slow. So while every once in a while Dr. Crow would lose a subject for a short period of time, he would always be able to round them up rather quickly and return them. There's also a variation of the tale that focuses less on the Dr. Crow and more on his wife. This time, Dr. Crow and his wife are living in an isolated cabin in the woods, have been asked to care for a group of children stricken with hydrocephalia, a disease that affects the cerebrospinal fluid in one's body, which causes the head to swell. Due to the swollen heads, mean-spirited locals began calling the children melon heads, and the name stuck. It's said that while assisting her husband and lovingly caring for the hydrocephalic children, Mrs. Crow began to see how the melon heads' nickname was hurting the children's feelings. Her motherly instincts kicking in, Mrs. Crow drew the children close to her, protecting them from the outside world. In turn, the children began to look at Mrs. Crow as their very own mother. Unfortunately, Mrs. Crow passed away one day, sending the children's collective world crashing down. Feeling they were now lost without their mother, the children panicked and began running and thrashing about the Crow cabin. Dr. Crow attempted to calm them, but to no avail. In the ensuing melee, a lit kerosene lantern was knocked to the floor, which set the old cabin on fire. Fed by the old wood of the cabin, the fire soon engulfed everything, including Dr. Crow and all the children. The melonheads said to roam the woods in this version are the ghosts of the children who burned to death in the cabin fire. The final legend associated with the melon heads doesn't even mention them, but it bears discussion because Dr. Crow is the central figure, and it's considered the most disturbing of all the variants. Here, Dr. Crow performs illegal abortions in his cabin in the woods, and even manages to find the time to kill a deformed baby or two in his spare time. Afterwards, he would bury the tiny bodies around the knoll near his cabin. Said to be abandoned now, the basement of the doctor's house is said to echo with the cries from the departed babies, as well as the area surrounding the knoll. With that in mind, it should come as no surprise that the bridge near where Dr. Crow's cabin is said to be is now officially known as a crybaby bridge. No matter where they came from, most kids in the area know somebody whose sister's best friend knew a guy whose dentist saw the melon heads one time. It's apparently a popular thing for local high school kids to do, is drive around the area late at night looking for them. Some say there was at one time a family with a mentally disabled child that had an oversized cranium who used to stand at the fence at the edge of his parents' property, and then all the myths and horror stories are much ado about this one kid. At any rate, the melon heads are most strongly associated with Wisner Road near Chardon. They are also often sighted on King Memorial Road, especially in or near the King Memorial Cemetery there. Why they like it here is anybody's guess. Maybe Dr. Crow and his wife are buried there and they come to visit the graves. that's made up, but it sounds like as good an explanation as any.
Right.
And then there's a couple of stories that people have reported. People saying, like, I saw a melon head here. They're telling the version of the story that they heard. I'll pick one, and I'll read that just so this doesn't go over long, since this is just a little postmortem. You can cut this, me doing this out. Here's one person who said, caught a glimpse of a melon head at Mitchell's Mill. I know lots about the melon head's myth. I know the Dr. Crow story is sort of true, but there are some facts missing. First of all, Dr. Crow did exist, but he lived in the 1940s and was a dentist. There could have been another Dr. Crow, though. Second, full moons have nothing to do with their nasty behavior, so I guess maybe some people think that they come out on full moons or something.
Okay.
I know this from experiences with them and from experiences that others have had. My first experiences with what I think were melon heads were on the east branch of the Chagrin River. My brother and I were driving along Mitchell's Mill, and I saw a quick flash out of the corner of my eye. I looked right and saw something by a tree. It was very blurry, and I was so scared I screamed at my brother and looked out of his window. What the hell was that? He said. I guess he saw it too, because he turned around at the spring and we headed back. This is near Mentor Road, which is off of Auburn. But there's just a list of accounts of people who I guess shared their personal melon heads experiences or sightings. So I wasn't totally off with some of the things that I remember from when I was a kid, but there's definitely more to that little, like, legend and different variations on it. In hindsight, I think it's very funny that is the story that, like, kept me up all night one time at a friend's house, like, of all the things. We were just convinced that melonheads were gonna, like, come out of the woods. But I don't know.
They still might.
They could. They're probably out there.
Well, I hope they're not, because that sounds like a miserable existence. Yeah. So. But that was cool, and I liked it, and I'm glad that we now know the right, I was going to say gourd, but melons aren't really a gourd.
The correct plant-based mm-hmm. head name. Head. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, guys. I do have, like, one small thing to say, and that is that I watched, like, a really, really good horror movie over the past week, and it's called Tigers Are Not Afraid. And it is about the struggle of some homeless kids in Mexico dealing with the cartel. But it has, like, a lot more involved in it. It's got, like, murder and supernatural stuff. And it is really, really good. It is a Spanish-language horror film. I loved it. And it's been a while since I was just like, yes, about a horror movie, like, through and through.
That's awesome. Thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah. I think I watched it on Shudder.
Okay.
You can find literally everything to do with us, including our social media, our Ko-Fi link, everything at 13club.com, which is XIIIclub.com.
And also, as a really brief aside, we're not going to get too much into details until we're 100% sure we're ready to release them, but we are working on some t-shirts and some merch is maybe something that might be possibly happening in the future. You feel like wearing a t-shirt with our name on it.
I'm going to.
So just, you know, we'll be sharing more info about that when it's ready.
But. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.